On the last episode, you asked how did Sam Mooney, Momo, Giancana get his name? Because they called him a lunatic. So that's why they called him Mooney.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. We're back in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, as you know by now, we are halfway or three-quarters away or maybe almost all the way through the Chicago Outfit Month of January. From here on out, January will always be a month-long series of stories about the Chicago Outfit because there is a never-ending supply of mob stories out of Chicago. Now, tonight, we've got a special guest. You probably have heard of him if you pay any attention to Chicago Outfit stories at all, and that's Frank Calabrese, Jr. It's good to have you here tonight, Frank. Welcome.
Thank you, Gary. My pleasure.
Well, great. You know, I remember when your book, Operation Family Secrets, How a Mobster's Son and the FBI Brought Down Chicago's Murderous Crime Family. And I kind of stumble over that word, murders. It was great. I bought it right off the bat because I had read somewhere that I knew about the Family Secrets. The Family Secrets investigation and subsequent trial, practically, it didn't end the Chicago Outfit, but it really dealt them a huge blow. They'd already been dealt a huge blow out of the straw man investigation for skimming from Las Vegas, but this thing just about put them under, I think. But it's a pretty resilient family up there, wouldn't you say, Frank?
Yeah. It's not like it was years ago. And yes, Operation Family Secrets was probably one of the final big cases. There's not much left now. You know, reason being, I mean, if you think about it, the government has so many weapons now, and anybody out there with a half a brain, if they're going to look at what you have to gain and what you have to lose, it's not worth it. You can't win.
You end up making about $10 an hour when you spend 10 years in the penitentiary, and then you look at how much money you made. You know, the cost-benefit analysis alone would stop a person committing crime. It'd stop me. You end up making $10 or $12 an hour, if even that. You know,
sure, because the federal government likes to label you, and they like to put initials on your docket. So with me, it's OC, organized crime. So if I went out and committed a crime, you're exactly right. I'm going to get at least 10 years. It's going to cost me $200,000 to $300,000 for an attorney. And the way the laws are now, they can take everything from me, and I have to prove that I got it to get it back legitimately. But yeah, it's a lose-lose situation.
Right. Now, Frank, we like to show all sides of our subjects. We've had Frank Collot on here. We've had Red Womet, who was a Chicago guy. If you probably have heard of him, you probably know Red even, maybe even knew him back in the day. Did you know Red back in the day?
No, I didn't know Red back in the day. We were heavy into the adult bookstores. I know where his bookstore was, but that wasn't one of ours, so I did not know him. Frank Collot, I know.
Yeah, and so we like to show all sides of our subjects.
What about Jim Pater?
Jim who?
No, he's Jim Pater. We had him on. He was a Chicago cop who you probably wouldn't know him because he was a homicide investigator. He was a guy, if you remember the two bodies they found in the drums in the back of a restaurant who were outfit collectors, and I can't remember their names now. He worked that case, and so we got him to do a call-in interview about the case, and we called it the janitors in a drum. Anyhow.
Okay. Yeah, I believe one of them was Jimmy Marcello's dad.
Exactly. He was a Marcello. I remember that. But we like to show kind of all sides of our subjects. And so could you tell us a little bit about your kind of like your childhood and your upbringing? You grew up there in kind of the near north side or west side of Chicago, reasonably close to downtown?
Yeah, my dad's side was Italian. They grew up in the Patch. Okay, grew up in the Patch, the Grand and Ogden area. That's an area where Tony Accardo came out of, the Scalachos came out of, Joey Lombardo. I mean, just names after names after names of guys. We slowly migrated down Grand Avenue as a young family. We wound up at the edge of the city, Harlem Avenue. That became Chicago's Little Italy in the later years, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The community I grew up in was probably about 50% Italian. I was half Italian, half Irish. You know, my childhood was great because, you know, a little difference from Chicago to New York is in New York, they brought their kids into the life. In Chicago, they kept their kids out of the life. So growing up as a young kid, you know, we really didn't see much, even though there was a lot of bosses, there were a lot of guys in the neighborhood that was kept from us. I had a pretty much normal upbringing as a young kid growing up. My father kept everything on the street. He didn't bring it in the house. My father was a family patriarch. He kept everybody together, and he made sure everybody never needed for anything. So my younger years, I grew up pretty normal.
Now, you guys moved to the Norridge area. What my research has revealed that your dad was connected to Angelo La Pietra, also known, I think they called him the Hook. He was a capo over the Chinatown area, Chinatown crew. Can you tell me a little bit about Angelo La Pietra and your father?
Sure. So we actually grew up in Elmwood Park, but prior to that, we rented a house in Norwich behind, I believe it was the old Warsaw, and that's where a lot of gangsters used to hang. Anyways, in 1966, I was 6 years old. My father was doing a lot of stuff on the street, and he came under the radar of the mob. He actually came under the radar of Angelo. So Angelo took him for a few months and groomed him and slowly brought him into the light. Angelo was a rising boss. He was originally out of Cicero. And then he took over the Chinatown area. He was, I would guess you would say, transferred to the Chinatown area, 26th Street area. And because my dad was with him, we were designated to that area, even though we were from Elmwood Park.
Interesting. It's Angelo, a little bit. Go ahead.
Angelo ruled with an iron fist. They called him the Hook because he'd hang his victims on a hook. He'd torture them with a ice pick. Okay, Angelo loved to rule by fear. Very treacherous man.
Now is he the guy?
Was he
responsible for the torturing of William Action Jackson, a loan shark that they thought was maybe erroneously thought was giving evidence to the government?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember exactly. I know he was involved in a lot. He was involved in the murder of John Mandel in our case. You know, he did come in the garage and torture him a little bit to get information. He was involved in a lot of murders. I don't know if Jackson was one of them. I wouldn't be able to answer that.
Yeah. You know, Frank, one thing I've noticed is I was a policeman down here, and my experience, well, I know of one guy that was hung up and tortured. They needed information out of him. I knew, you know, later on when they found his body, they found the evidence, and it was quite obvious, you know, what they wanted out of him, because there was a little mob war going on. They needed to find out about the other side. But boy, it seems like in Chicago, there's a lot of torturing going on as we've looked at some of these different cases, you know, Mad Sam DiStefano and people like that in this Action Jackson case. It's like, you know, what's up with that, do you think?
The German.
Yeah, Frank the German.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Chicago, they did torture. A lot of times there was a reason why. They just didn't do it because they loved it, although most people you talk to with Mad Sam, they'd say, no, he loved it. They had their reasons, and it was funny because they always used to say, in Chicago you'd be found tortured with your throat cut, and in New York, they shoot you while you wait. That was a little bit of a difference. But, you know, I don't know, because there were crews in New York that's all they did was torture and cut people up. So there's a reason why they, in fact, my father's preferred method of killing somebody was to strangle them first, then cut their throat ear to ear. My father loved knives. and he loved that being close, that hands on, you know, make sure that, you know, he got the job done.
I think
he's also part of one of two crews that did all the dirty work for when we called them heavy work for the outfit, you know, because they were good at what they did. And not until years later did things start changing where the crews would split up of the same hit and work together. At one time, there was one crew, and they did it from start to finish. My father's crew was good at it. The bosses liked that.
I think I had read online in an interview about your father. They called it the Calabrese noose.
Calabrese necktie.
Necktie, that was it.
So, Frank.
It's really derived from Sicilian necktie, where the Sicilian necktie, you go one step further, you reach up in the throat and pull their tongue out.
Thanks for that little extra bit of information there.
But that's it. You know, the great thing about getting the opportunity to talk to you has to be, you know, some of the small details that you, I did some research, I was reading online, I was watching some of the YouTube video interviews that you had done, and, you know, and trying to, you know, kind of do some research for the opportunity that we get here to talk to you. And so some of that subtle detail is the meat and bones of what we get to do here at Gangland Wire.
Now,
you know, you remember something too. When you come into this life, when you're brought in, they'll ask you, can you do this? Can you do that? Are you capable of doing this? But just because you say you can do it doesn't mean that, that they believe you, so they test you. But you might go sometimes and think that you're actually going to kill somebody, and in the end, they're going to push you all the way up till even the person you think you're killing is in on it too, because they want to test you. You know, another thing too, when even on my tour, I talk a lot of stories about details about how I learned how to survive on the street, and I learned these from these people that you're talking about. You know, and in the movies, you think a bunch of guys just sit down and say, "Hey, we're going to go kill this guy." They get in the car and they go. You know, there's weeks and months of laying on a guy, you know, sitting in a van with all windows with, it looks like a refrigerator box sitting in the van with little holes in it. You're sitting in that box with a jug of water, a jug for pee, and some food and binoculars. And you learn somebody, you learn their every move, you know, kind of like the stuff you see in movies with spies and stuff. And this is what they did, because you can't make mistakes. The government can make mistakes. Law enforcement can make mistakes. We can't make a mistake. One mistake can cost you your life or your freedom. So there's a lot of stuff that went into this, not just what you see in the movies.
I'm just looking here at the Wikipedia about your father, and it's this was saying federal government estimated the Calabrese crew grossed more than $2.6 million.
Yeah, that was just that one case. That was basically off of, my father was probably, if not the biggest, one of the biggest goose loan operators in the city. He had a lot of money on the street. He ran his operation. He turned in money. You know, my father taught me, he says, you never talk about wanting to move up in this life. You always be happy with what you got. You always do what they ask you to do, and you always earn for them because you will be needed. As soon as you're not needed anymore, things could change for you. So, you know, and he lived all three of those for many years. I've seen him live it.
You know, Frank, tell us just a little bit about, you know, you talk there about learning from your father about this. Now, when you were a teenager, you were like a normal teenager that went to high school and played on the football team. And did you go to a parochial high school?
No, I was very good in football. So the high school I went to was a Catholic high school. To play football. They were one of the top teams in the state. I made the stupid mistake as a young teenager that in my junior year, I quit the team because I didn't like the coach, and I threw my equipment at him and left. And, you know, years later, I wish I would have never did that because I really loved playing football, maybe even when we got a scholarship to college. But, yeah, growing up as a teenager, my life was normal. As I started getting into high school, little things that my father would test me or groom me, and he would, you know, would give me little things to do. I actually started going during high school with my uncle running the bookstores, collecting. And so that's when I got involved. But when I did it, it wasn't because I thought I was getting involved in the mob. I was doing it because my father asked me to do it, like any kid, you know, do this, son, you know, be a good son and do this for your dad. He needed me to do something. I couldn't wait to get done because I wanted to go hang at the park. I wanted to play sports. I wanted to socialize with girls. You know, I wanted to go to college just like everybody else. I never thought I would go into this life. And eventually, more and more, he's seen a lot of, him and me, and he slowly brought me in, and at that point, I bought it. I bought into it, and I was good at what I did.
I was just reading some of the stuff I found online. It was just start out as simple, you know, taking envelopes with cash and delivering them.
Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure what he was doing, but I had an idea, you know, and but I was taught not to ask questions and mind your own business. I only pay attention to what he tells me to pay attention to. Well, what he was doing this whole time was slowly grooming me.
Now, as a teenager...
No, until it became the norm.
As a teenager, noticing in your book that you and your extended family all lived in a three-story house. Who all lived in that home? Kind of tell us a little bit about what that was like. Your father was kind of like the major domo.
Oh, well, you know, in Chicago, there's a lot of three flats, we call them, okay? I called that the compound. Okay, it was a three flat with a huge addition on the back corner of it. Okay, and it was all family in there. You know, different times, different family members. At one time, you know, my aunt, my one uncle, my brother and sister lived upstairs with my grandparents on the top floor. We lived in the middle floor. My other uncle with his family lived on the bottom floor. Another aunt lived across the street, so everybody was close to the house. We had a big family room. The doors were all open to every apartment all the time, so it was very, very family-like. I grew up, it was great. I mean, it was great growing up there. I had a lot of great memories.
It was probably the kind of neighborhood where you and all the neighborhood kids were out in the park until in the summertime until they made you come in at 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night and just ran the streets, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, my father was very strict. So when those street lights went on, we had to be home. And if we weren't, he'd whistle twice. If you didn't hear it, you were in trouble. You'd get a kick in your rear. So, you know, and again, in the neighborhood, there were a lot of rules, too. So as kids, we were taught those rules to respect the neighborhood, respect your neighbors, respect your elders. There was a lot of rules growing up. So, you know, it was great. Really was. Nice, safe place to live.
You mentioned kind of a subject near and dear to our heart here in Kansas City, having vacations in Las Vegas as a teenager, and you seem to have good connections out there. You know, Chicago had great connections in the 60s and 70s in Las Vegas. Do you remember any of those?
Oh, definitely. I used to go. Me and my brother used to go with my father all the time. We used to go out there sometimes with my mother. Sometimes with my grandmother, my mother, and my father, and then other times I go with my father, and there were a lot of other guys out there that brought their kids, too. All the kids would hang together. The fathers would do their thing. They'd all be out by the pool at the Stardust playing gin rummy, and we'd all be swimming in the water, you know, and in the pool. And, yeah, I remember, you know, I remember Vegas very well back then. I was just a kid. I knew Tony Spilatro. I knew Michael Spilatro. I know Dr. Pat was my dentist for many years growing up, the oldest brother. It's ironic because Dr. Pat was actually the toughest of all the brothers, and he was the legit one. But, you know, I do remember a lot of Vegas, stories. I used to get a big kick out of everybody getting paged under fake names, you know, and we got a big kick out of it with kids. We didn't really understand why, other than they didn't want anybody to know that they were there, what we were told. But we never questioned it, you know. In many years, my dad told me that at one point that he might have had a opportunity to go out there, kind of like Tony did, okay? There was an opportunity on two ends. There was one end, the opportunity through the mob, to go out there and move out there. And then the other opportunity was my Uncle Ed Hanley was the International President of Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, which ran every hotel in Vegas. And my uncle wanted my dad to come out there and work for him, the union out there. My dad did not leave. He said, I passed on all of that. His concern with working for the union was he wasn't really good in school because he only had an eighth grade education. So that's what he passed on there. But years later, I think he always kind of wishes maybe that's the route he would have went. He'd probably still be around now and probably have a $150,000, $200,000 pension and be retired.
Made all the difference in the world, didn't it? Aaron, you got a question?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious if you ever, when you were in Vegas, got to eat at the Upper Crust.
The Upper Crust. I know that sounds so familiar. I just don't remember if I did.
That was Frank Culotta's place. That was probably after, he probably had that after you were out there as a teenager. More than likely, you know.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, because I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s, okay. When I was a young kid going out there with my father. I didn't go out there till the 80s again, you know, without them.
So you're a teenager, you're growing up, your father is grooming you. You make that pretty evident, and it's pretty descriptive how you talk about that, how he would test you with little things, give you little jobs to see how you'd act and react. You kind of struck out on your own reading in your book that you committed a burglary in the Elmwood Park area. And I know enough in the Columbus Park area here in Kansas City. I remember a young kid that was running around here doing burglaries, and the next thing they know, they found him dead with his cotton gloves on in the Columbus Park. So what happened when your dad found out about that burglary that you did?
Well, one thing I found out that I had in common with my dad was I loved to steal. I stole as a kid in grammar school, and just for no reason whatsoever, just I don't know what even made me do it. It wasn't like I was needing for anything, so I did it. Ironic part was that when I came home with my little sack, you know, I did it like watching out of a movie, right? And my little pillowcase sack, I came home, I hid it somewhere, and in middle of the night, my dad wakes me up. It's my dad and my uncle there, and they're holding it. And I'm like, wow. I'm thinking, how did they find that like that, you know? And I'm just kind of dumbfounded. But here I hid it in the same spot that they were hiding all their bookwork. So, actually, but yeah, my father sat me down. He told me, you know, what happens to people that steal in this neighborhood? It's a no-no. He wanted to sit me down and find out why I wanted to steal, what made me think about it. And for the first time ever, he grounded me for a couple of weeks. Prior to that, most of the time we would get either the belt or a kick in the rear or a slap in the back of the head. And that was the first time I ever got grounded. And you know what? It really bothered me because many times I was like, oh boy, I probably would have rather got slapped or kicked or got the belt because it'd be over with after a while. So, you know, he told me you can lose your hands for stealing in this neighborhood, maybe even your life.
Yeah, that's a huge no-no, I think, in every ethnic Italian neighborhood in the United States. You do not, you're going to steal, you better go outside the neighborhood. Talking about your father grooming you, when is one of the first things, one of the more important things you remember that you realized he was grooming you? And I guess in a follow-up or maybe a pre-question, did you ever have like the talk about, I noticed they Tony Soprano did that with I think his daughter Meadow, kind of the talk about what dad really does. Did you ever have that talk?
My dad wouldn't give you any information. It was more of a need to know information. So as a kid, I had an idea, but he never sat down and told us. In fact, I remember being a young kid in grammar school and saying, Dad, you know, I got to go to school. I got to do a report on what you do for a job, and I don't know what to tell him. And I remember, and he said, I'm an engineer. I says, you mean like trains? I never seen you drive a train. He says, no, operating engineer, local 150, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and I asked him a few questions about that. And what he told me, I just said, okay. So he told me what to do. I didn't question it because that's the way we were taught. That's the way we were brought up. Mind your own business. If you have a question, ask. But there were certain things you wouldn't ask questions about. Now, I'm 12 years old in 1972, I believe it was, when Godfather came out. That's when we got an idea of what my father did. Okay, and when I say an idea, you know, as a young kid, the other 12-year-olds, you think you know, but really you don't. But I had an idea that my father is not like some other fathers here of my friends. But then there were some friends of mine that their fathers were the same way. We kind of knew it, but we really never talked about it because, you know, we really didn't care that much. We weren't really impressed with what they did. All we knew is they provided for us. They told us if we got in trouble, we were going to get a beating. They told us, go to school, you better get good grades. And they told us to be respectful around the neighborhood. But we just did what they said.
I have to tell you that I grew up in South Dakota, and it sounds like my father, and he was an engineer too. But he was a mining engineer.
But he wasn't a real engineer.
He was a mining engineer.
He was a mining engineer. Oh.
It's a little different than an operating engineer. What is an operating engineer? I believe that they like drive heavy equipment, handle heavy equipment. Isn't that what the Operating Engineers Union locals are for, heavy equipment operators?
Yes.
That's exactly correct. That's why they might have wanted to have him go out to Vegas and run that. You know, that would be a powerful position to be in, you know, working in a, you know, hotel employees union.
Yeah, that would have been nice for the outfit to have somebody in that union, because that's especially the Chicago outfit. They have infiltrated a union or two, a la the Teamsters.
Yeah, Definitely, definitely. You know, I mean, well, for many years, I mean, how many times did Accardo and my uncle Ed Hanley have to go in front of U.S. Senate committee, but, you know, they never, nothing ever came of it. My uncle ran that union well, even though, you know, it was alleged to have crime ties for many years. I mean, heck, my uncle came out, my uncle on my Irish side came out of the Cicero local. So, you know, figure that, go figure that, right?
Really? You were a pretty good boxer, Red. Tell us a little bit about how you got into boxing.
You know, as a kid, you know, I was very, very emotional. I didn't want to fight anybody if I didn't have to. I wanted to be everybody's friend. Kind of looked like Obie Taylor growing up, you know, and Ron Howard. And whenever I'd get into a fight, if somebody picked on me, a bully or something like that, I fought and I did well, but I cried the whole time, but I'd win. As a young kid, my dad would put the gloves on us with other his friends' kids, and I did okay. As a teenager, I decided I wanted to box because some of my friends were boxing and they were very successful. Well, my father said, there's no way I can ever box, so I snuck behind his back. I went over to the park. I fought. I fought in a Stoll fight. Tony Zale was at that fight. Tony Zale seen that fight, and with 16-ounce gloves, I really beat the crap out of a kid, which is very hard to do. And it was a kid that had a lot more experience than me. So I got in the golden gloves. I walked through the tournament. I won. And my father found out. He wasn't happy about it. I talked about doing more after that. But, you know, I was making good money. I had a girlfriend. And I didn't want to put in the time to do it. So, you know, I was good with my hands. I'm a southpaw. And that was something my father noticed, too.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you one more skill that he realized he could use for you out of you in the future, and so he could continue to groom you. Probably why he didn't dissuaded you discouraged you from continuing in any kind of a career in the boxing ring. Of course, that's a tough business for anybody to ever make any money out of. So you went into the nightclub business as a young man.
I did. You know, I always worked. You know, that's what saved me to this day. I always worked. As a young kid in grammar school, I had the biggest paper route. You know, back then when you go to the place and you'd pick up your papers, you'd roll them. You had your banana seat bike with the raised handlebars with the hooks. Get your bag there and you'd ride it down the street and throw the papers. It was funny because I had the biggest route in town out of that shop. And all my friends worked. And then I went from that, and I started working at an Italian pizza place. You know, 14, 15 years old, I had to go get permission from my dad. The owner said, if it's okay with your dad, fine with me. You know, and there weren't no strict laws back then. So I would work on weekends as long as it didn't affect my grades. And then out of high school, my dad got me a city job. And during the city job, I was always out doing other jobs, side work, always making money. You know, I worked in a nightclub as a doorman. My father didn't like that either. But I figured I was going to be there anyways. Why not get paid for it? Hang in there anyways. And then me and a buddy of mine had an opportunity to open up our own place. And we did. You know, we were young. We had the first campaign room or VIP lounge in Chicago. We had a lot of ideas we wanted to do, and we were very successful at it.
What year was this?
Oh, in the early 80s.
So was that one of those Rush Street bars that I've heard about that are so popular with all the young professionals from downtown?
We were out on the west end of the city. That's where our place was. You know, more neighborhoody.
So at some point in time, you're running this nightclub and you're getting in your 20s and becoming a man. At some point in time... Frank Sr. brings you on in a little closer into his loan sharking business, which was huge at the time and got bigger and bigger all the time. And I guess he probably worked hand in glove with gamblers to know who needed money and who owed money and who didn't. Well,
by the time I had the nightclub in my early 20s, I was already working with my dad. I was more so doing a lot of his bookwork. Sitting with him, learning the book work. Actually, that's how I learned all my math. You know, what interest and principal, percentages and all that was from my dad and working on the street. I wasn't good in school at math. But, I actually worked a job worked at the nightclub, and also helped my dad, worked with my dad. So it was like having three jobs. When my dad first found out I wanted to do the nightclub again, he wasn't happy with it. And after a while, he actually would use it as a meeting place to meet some of his guys in the basement, because they can come in a back door and leave. And it was a big basement, so they can go anywhere in the basement. So it was hard to monitor anything, you know. So the club was actually going well until the guy that went partners with me and my partner was Jimmy Marcello's nephew. So it was me and my partner, Johnny Eliotto. And when this guy found out who my father was and who Jimmy Marcello was, he got kind of nervous and just locked us out of the place one day. So we had a big issue with that. But I think he thought we were going to take everything from him, which we would have never did. We were going to give him a fair shot. So
tell us a little bit about the Frank Calabrese Sr. Loan sharking business. How did that work?
My father had, you know, there's a few traits that they look for to bring to when you come into the life, you know, an earner. Can you handle yourself, tough? And, you know, a lot of them are thieves at some point. My dad built his loan sharking business off. My dad was a good businessman when it came to that. You know, he'd take collateral. He wouldn't bury anybody. He, you know, he had a whole list of questions when you borrowed money. And he was smart because, you know, in the movies you see if somebody doesn't pay the money right away, you're going to hurt them or put them in the hospital. And my father's philosophy was, if I do that, how are they going to pay me my money? So my father was pretty fair. If you really couldn't pay the money and you were having a hard time, so say you borrowed $2,000 at 10% and, you know, you were paying so much a week and all of a sudden you couldn't pay anymore. If you were having problems paying, he might take that $2,000 and say, I'll make it $4,000. Loan me $4,000. It's all principal now. And pay me every week. What can you afford? If the guy said $25 a week, my dad say, okay, $25 every week will come off. As long as the guy made a good effort to do that, my dad was fine with him. It was the guys that were gambling or doing stuff wrong or avoiding him. And then, you know, you'd get a warning. You get two warnings. One of the second warning was usually a cupped hand slapped to the side of the head, put you on the ground to let you know that you better start paying. Very seldom did he have to resort all the way to extreme violence. Most people got the message and paid. So he built up a huge, huge operation.
You know, and there's really no use. It's kind of counterproductive to actually kill a loan shark customer, because as long as you just stay on them and stay on them, you're probably going to continue to get paid. May not get it all as soon as you want it, but if you kill them, then there is no money unless there's some kind of insurance policy somebody's taking out on them. But
most of the clients that my dad had were successful businessmen, and when they just needed money quick, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, and they paid all the time. And we had collateral, too, if they didn't, okay? So he did not get a lot of bust outs. He made sure he was only going to give money to people that were capable of paying. You know, my father's philosophy was, don't bury somebody either. He says, you bury a legit guy, he says, and you make him give him all your money, and he goes home to his wife, and his wife asks where the money's at, and he says, well, I have to give it to Frank Calabrese. He goes, who do you think's the one that's going to call the FBI? The wife. Then you're going to cause problems. Why do you want that? So he had a great system. He really did. Even with booking, too. You know, he'd give you permission to bet. Two things you couldn't do. Okay, first he'd give you a number of how much you can gamble. And number two, if he found out you were playing with anybody else, that was a big no-no.
Well, and then he was actually, I guess the term is here, you'd find online, whistled in by Angelo the Hook LaPietra.
Well, you know, you start doing stuff on the street and people start noticing you. And, you know, they noticed what he was doing, and that they gave him a choice, you know. Well, they didn't give him a choice. They told him, now you're with us. And my father knew it, you know, and he went with it.
So,
you know, and then Angelo gave him money to borrow to put on the street, which he paid him back.
I just said that Angelo probably had ability to lay off bets as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was, you know, that's the whole part of the booking. Yeah, you know, I was talking about more so for loan sharking, but yeah, for booking, yeah, I mean, there was a whole procedure you did. You had places to lay off. You know, it was very organized. It was very well organized for a while, and they tried to organize it more and more all the time. Years, you know, percentages and everything. After a while, I remember when I was involved. After a while, you know, so many guys would try to sneak a few guys here, sneak a few guys there. So finally, my father said, that's it, street tax. Everybody's paying a tax. I don't care. You're gambling. You know, this is what you're paying. Most guys pay the $1,000 a week. This way I get my $1,000 a week from all these guys out there, and I don't have to worry about what they do. Win, lose, I don't care. I'm getting $1,000 a week. Every week they pay me.
I'm just thinking about all those. The few times I've gotten the opportunity to be in Chicago and how many hot dog carts are just there, and you never think, like, I might not be making money just on hot dogs.
Yeah. Taking bets, yeah. That was a huge deal. And that street tax thing that they came up with in Chicago, that kind of gravitated to other cities, too. It was and getting them all organized. I read something that one of the bosses said, I want everybody organized like they had back in the old days during the Prohibition. So they lined up all the bookmakers and just charged them a street tax. And the porn shops, too. That's what Red Womette was paying, like $500 a week or something to Frank Suisse, to Joey Lombardo, actually. So it was a pretty efficient organization.
Same thing. I was just going to say, another thing they had was you had to turn in a list of who your players were, because bosses wanted it so that these players couldn't go and play two or three different places and cause problems. So once you gamble through somebody, you belong to them. You couldn't go to somebody else, and they, you know, and if they found out you went to somebody else, now you can have a problem.
That's
why everybody paid.
Yeah.
And
it was, everybody pays.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to end up on the hook,
yeah, you don't want to end up on the hook
or the other.
You know, Frank, that's one of the things about the mob I've noticed in all cities, Kansas City, Chicago, other cities, is they have this proprietary interest. If you're with somebody, it's like, you're with me. I own you. You don't do anything unless I approve of it once you go in under somebody. And it's like that in every city. I guess it's a way to keep control.
You're theirs for life.
Yeah. And you got to remember something, too, okay? All right. You have a successful business. We're going to find you. And we're going to make you our partner. You have no choice. You know, in the movies, everybody thinks it's this great, big, loyal thing, right? Like, everybody's, oh, I want to be part of it. No. I've had guys tell me on the street now that made tons of legitimate money that were around when Angelo was around and my father was around, a lot of those guys. He says, you know what, Frank? Things are a lot nicer now. And, you know, and what they meant was, you know, we not have somebody that we, you know, guess what? You're my partner now. Okay. How much you making? This is what I want. That's how it was. And if you didn't pay, you'd get warnings. If you didn't get the warnings, they'd kill you. And it's evident in my case with Family Secrets.
Now that's one thing I noticed. I noticed you talked about in the book is, and I've seen that here in Kansas City, and I'm sure it happens, is the extortion of a legitimate businessman. You find somebody who maybe books bets, so they, you know, hangs out at certain clubs. So you get to know a lot about them, what are their weaknesses and who they are. And if they're successful, but they're kind of part of this underground, underworld lifestyle, if they like to hang out there and be around that, they kind of put themselves at risk. And so they'll send a guy like you and one of your buddies, a couple of big young guys over and threaten them. Then the older guy will come in and say, hey, you know, I understand you got some problems here. I can take care of that, but here's what it's going to cost you. Was that how it worked for you guys?
Sure, that's how it worked. Okay. I mean, first of all, we're trained to manipulate you. People are infatuated with mobsters, organized crime. They want to be around it. They think it's cool. All right, well, when you're around it, you're going to go to places where you don't have to wait in line, where you can get a table, where you're going to meet celebrities, where you can get girls. What we're really doing is finding out what your vices and weaknesses are, because that's how we're going to exploit you. We already know, before we let you hang around us, what you have that we want. Okay? And once we get it from you, either you're going to walk away and give it to us, or they're going to put you in the ground. You know, it's another thing, too. It's funny because the way Chicago worked years and years ago, I mean, it worked this way. But if you owned a business down here on Rush Street, you paid the beat cop, you paid the ward committee man, bag man, and you paid the mop. But you never had no problems at your restaurant. You never had no problems around your restaurant. If you were full, you could stay open later. Nobody would cause any problems in your restaurant. So, you know, you paid everybody, but you made money. And it worked at one time. Kind of ironic, huh?
Yeah, really. It's you know, it sounds like Kansas City in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and by the 60s it started turning around. It took a little bit longer for Chicago to turn around, because the outfit was, I once put up a I got a picture of a table of organization of the Chicago outfit in the 70s with Accardo at the top and then Iupa right alongside there. You never really knew it for a while. I think Iupa was more like the out front guy and Accardo was really the boss at back behind, but it had all the different crews, you know, Chinatown and Elmwood Street or Elmwood Park and what was it, Grand Avenue and Taylor Street and all the people underneath all of them. And then I put one up of Kansas City. It was like, oh my God, it's a joke down here comparatively. The whole mob in Kansas City isn't as big as one of your big crews up there.
Yeah, I mean, it was run, you know, they say that Chicago, the way Chicago was structured was they learned from all the mistakes that New York made with the five families. That's why they wanted one. Chicago was more underground, blending with your surroundings. New York still went to the social club on the corner and waited for the boss to come. They were very in the open, whereas Chicago was like, times are changing. After they went through everything with doing the bootlegger wars, they had to change. You got to remember, once the FBI came in, things changed. So they had to change. They had to change with the times. There's no more prohibition. How do you make money? And Chicago always found ways. Labor unions, Las Vegas. I mean, look at Tony Accardo. He had the vending companies with, you know, people nowadays don't understand that, you know, cigarette vending machines made huge money. And back then, all the slot machines in Vegas all came through Accardo's company. But they were always looking for more legit ways to make money, more legit ways to blend in with your surroundings, more legit ways so people would say there is no more mob that left with Al Capone. That's what we wanted people to think.
You know, one thing you talked about out there that I really found and really resonated with me and is like, oh yeah, that makes sense, was when you were talking about blending in, when you talked about some of your father's instructions and how you guys conducted yourselves, what kind of clothes you wore and the cars you drove and how you blended in all the time to not be noticeable and to you didn't wear the track suits with a big gaudy gold around your neck and hang out on the street in front of the social club. So tell our listeners a little bit about that. I found that really interesting because it was just like that in Kansas City.
Well, you know, again, you wanted to blend in with your surroundings in your neighborhood, because remember, when the FBI wants to find out about you, the first thing they do is go talk to your neighbors. Now, naturally, you don't know that because your neighbors ain't going to come and say, oh, the FBI just sat down with me and asked me a bunch of questions about you. Because that might not be the smartest thing for them to do. But you want your neighbors to perceive you as somebody that you're really not. You're the best neighbor in the world. You're a good family man. And you're getting on the street. We don't meet in restaurants. We don't talk on the phone, okay? We walk in the cover of darkness in the middle of the night. We change. If I'm going to meet you today and we're going to meet again next week, what I'm going to do is we're going to set up the location today. Why talk on the phone? When we talk in code, we use opposite gender. We use code names. I mean, I've had like five nicknames. You know, the name was constantly changed, sometimes in one conversation. Smiley, Junior, Sad Sack, Murphy. And if my father was talking to me, you might think me and him are talking about five different girls. And in reality, we're just talking about me. It was very important. We pretend like every time we did something, when we were on the clock, the FBI was watching or they were listening. And I used that all my life. You know, always remember, you know, don't carry anything in your hands. If I bought a hot dog and had it in a bag and there's surveillance on me, surveillance is going to think there's a hot dog in the bag. No. We were always taught, never carry anything in your hands when you meet. If you got money, put your hands in your pocket. And when you shake hands and hug, that's when you transfer the money. Gangways. We'd meet in hospitals. We'd meet in McDonald's. Anywhere where you didn't think we were. And you would think it was just, oh, just a normal family, just a father, son, or, you know, a group of guys having coffee or something. A lot of the older guys, there's very many surveillance pictures of them. It just looks like a bunch of old guys talking about their retirement, where they're going to go off. And here in some of these pictures, surveillance pictures, they're planning major murders. They're running the city. They're running part of the country.
Well, you just made a whole lot more sense of a lot of things I used to see and wonder about, because the only thing you can do is just watch it many times, especially on a local level. We didn't have any wiretaps here. And then the wiretaps, when they got them up, they were just for usually a limited duration, working on one particular case. So then you could make sense out of things. But it's, you know, taking those kinds of precautions and blending in like that's how it works, folks. I've seen it. I've been on the other side, watched that, and sat and wondered, you know, talking about those code names and calling you Sad Sack and these different names. Frank, I want to play a little audio. It's on your website and it's on your YouTube site. It's an audio of Frank Jr. talking to his dad, Frank Sr., while Frank Sr. is in a prison waiting room. I'm going to play this, and then I want to ask you a couple of questions about it. Okay, play that, Aaron.
Sure.
Well, let me ask you something. How's the Curly Girl doing? She wasn't cooking no more. She wasn't going to cook no more. She said she wasn't cooking, that the health inspectors came in and were giving her a hard time.
So, Frank, this says something about the curly-headed girl. What did that mean? And what kind of were the circumstances that you got that audio and video?
What happened was my father, when I went against my father's side of why you're in prison, you know, my father was very, very street smart. You know, he could smell a rat a mile away twice. In my time with him, one, he knew a guy was cooperating right away. He called it out. He was right. Later on, the second time, a guy was an FBI agent undercover. Called that out right away in 2 minutes. So when I was in prison doing the recordings against my dad, the only advantage I had was I knew my dad better than anybody else because I spent, you know, 20 years with him, 20 plus years with him on the street. When I got out, he was under the assumption that I was going to run the crew with him, with the guy he had running the crew with him while he was on the street. When I went to meet him, when I first got out of prison, the mob killed this guy. It was a power move. His name was Ronnie Jarrett. He was running my father's crew. I went in prison to visit my father because he wanted to know what was going on the street. So I am telling him in code everything that's going on the street. In that conversation right there, the guy that used to work for us, okay, had curly hair. So we're talking about in code, we want to find out if he went to another crew. He claimed that he wasn't doing anything anymore because he got whistled in with the FBI and he didn't want to do anything. And my father didn't believe it. So I am telling my father information. So naturally, we're describing somebody. We use opposite gender. The cooking or the chef or recipes was about money. And the other ironic part about all this was the fact that when I was going over everything with the prosecutor for the trial, he would play this video, and he's even though he knew all the code words and everything, he still couldn't understand. Like he'd say, so that's really recipes there. He said, no, he's talking money there. He's not talking recipes. And then the other part, he goes, oh, he's talking money there. I go, no, he's really talking about a recipe. So we did this for years. You got so used to doing it every day that it was second nature. And we could understand each other. It was very, very easy to understand each other. The advantage that the FBI had through all this was on the last recording in prison with my dad, we talked about what we were going to use for code words on everything. So they actually had a dictionary already of all the code words. If not, nobody would have understood it.
So that probably helped. There's a second video out there of a couple of, they describe them, ex-cops, Frank Ricci and Anthony Twan Doyle, talking with your dad. And they use
Mike Ricci and Anthony Twan Doyle.
Yeah. Oh, was it Mike? They're using they used the word curly-headed girl and talking about somebody's looking to change companies. They've lost confidence in things. Have you seen that? Do you know what that was about? I'll play that right now. Go ahead and play
that. Yeah, they were also...
Go ahead and play that, Aaron.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, who gave the message? I mean, Mitch passed it on to who? To his brother. And his brother is going to pass it on.
Sad Sack?
Yeah.
And Sad Sack was supposed to?
Yeah.
That was supposed to be done directly.
All right. So, that meeting, Mike Ricci... and Anthony Twan Doyle, I meet with my dad. They're both Chicago police officers. And Mike Ricci was also Frank Sinatra's bodyguard when he was in town for years. Both these guys moonlighted working with us. They're in there because, one, Mike Ricci is running the Cook County ankler bracelet monitoring program, okay, and the FBI paid him a visit. And it's all a ruse to get Mike to go back and tell my father what's going on. Anthony Twan Doyle worked in the evidence room, and he's telling him about the FBI coming again to get a bloody glove. During that conversation, they're also talking about this curly-haired guy. Again, he's telling them what I told them, what I found out. And also in that conversation, they're talking about my Uncle Nick, if he's really going to stand up. Actually, Anthony Doyle talks about sticking a cow prodder up my uncle's rear. And also talks about the evidence in the locker. The codes that they're using for the evidence, I believe, was a lady's purse for the bloody glove. They were using code words for Ronnie Jarrett. They were using code words for my uncle. I actually testified to that conversation in court. Gary, you know that being in law enforcement, never will a judge allow you to get on the stand and cooperate and talk about a conversation that you weren't part of, especially if it's in code. Well, I knew the code words so well that the judge actually allowed me to. And I broke down that whole conversation. It was a very, very important conversation in the trial.
That's interesting. I've heard some of those on some of our own tapes here in Kansas City, and actually that we had one of Tuffy DeLuna and this Joe Augusto out in Las Vegas explaining what the code words would be for an airplane coming in and the time, and they got so confused that finally Tuffy said, you know, he said, just call me at home and tell me just before you're coming or something like that. So they couldn't keep it straight. That's hard stuff to keep straight. I admire you for being able to keep that straight.
Well, you know what it was? We do like the military, right? You practice it every day, every day, every day, till it becomes part of your life. You know, another thing my father taught me real quick, okay, you know, there was a lot put into before you met somebody to make sure we called that you were clean, that you weren't being followed. Because if you were being followed, you don't go meet that person. Well, not only did we do that, my father took it to another extreme. If my appointment was at 8 o'clock with a guy, he wanted me in there at 7:45. He wanted me in the area. He wanted me in an area where the other person couldn't see me to watch to make sure they weren't being followed. Because who knows? Maybe they got in a fight with their girlfriend, they're running late, they just get in their car and they drive right there and they bring the FBI. But we had to watch, and there were times where you could see, I remember one time I seen this guy was being followed, they were all over the place. So I just left. Later on he called me, he says, hey, you weren't there. I said, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, a few days later he showed up at his house at the back door. I said, you know what, don't ever do that again. You know, so I mean, these were things I learned that, you know, you don't even think of. Unless somebody teaches you. Nowadays, there's nobody out there to teach you this anymore.
Well, so part of what happened with the kind of with your father, as I understand it, reading online, is that your father had a lot of recipes over at your grandmother's house, a lot of them, and you were going over there and taking 50 recipes out without asking.
Well, there was a discrepancy on $500. I was going to collect from the guy that got gunned down. I was going to collect from somebody. And there was a discrepancy on what month started. Was it December or January? So that's what we were talking about. And I was leaving the money by my grandmother's house because his wife would come there and get it.
Okay.
But what he was saying in that conversation is it's $500 off.
But he basically is, in that instance, accusing you of skimming off of the... He expects a certain amount of money to show up. And if it's not there in the envelope,
right.
Or
right.
The recipes, if it's not, obviously you took it.
Something don't fit, right? So what he thinks, he says you're probably just cooking a little bit, maybe out that way, for a few select people.
Yeah.
You know,
the party. Or trying to jump ship going to another restaurant.
Yeah, right. We were going back and forth because I had stole from him once before. You know, and in the trial, I talked about, you know, because I get up on the stand and I knew my father was going to try to take everything away from the tapes and talk about the money I took from him. And in reality, my father owed me a lot of money, too. I went and took his money. I was going to replace the money that I owed him. But then again, I got brave and I said, screw it. But when I got in the trial, hey, I took all this money from him. So ever since that point on, he kept accusing me. He actually accused me in trial of stealing a bunch of cars and a bunch of money. But he couldn't prove it. But it didn't happen. They brought everybody up there that stole the car. I mean, everybody that bought cars. And they put my picture up there, and they're like, no, that wasn't a guy that sold it to me.
Well, like you said yourself.
Yeah, he was constantly accusing.
You would do anything, for your father? I mean, as you were, you were in the life, you were living the life, and your father had these essentially three different personalities: the charming gentleman, the man who would slap you around, threaten you personally, and then the guy that would kill people.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, at one point, yeah, I bought into it all. I loved my father, but I didn't buy into the mob. I wasn't intrigued with the mob. I didn't like a lot of things they did. I didn't. And first of all, I'm half Irish, too. So what I bought into was I bought into my family. I bought into the family structure. I bought into my uncle. I bought into my dad. I bought into my brothers. You know, we unite together. We make money. It was more of a business thing. And if anybody crosses up or try to hurt us, we protect each other. That's what I bought into. What I had seen over the years, not just me, but people close, family members, is the longer my dad spent with Angelo, the more he became more of a sociopathic person. His personality started changing. He became more controlling, more violent, quicker with his hands, paranoid. And my father, unfortunately, felt that if we were very successful without him, that we wouldn't love him if we didn't need him. So he had this fear of controlling us at all times. So what we've seen him becoming more and more like Angelo over the years and losing his soul and becoming more violent. And at that point, that's when I started to change my mind about if I wanted to do what I wanted.
Frank, this has been great. Invite you back for a second episode, and we'll discuss the Family Secrets trial and your Uncle Nick, which we have not talked about, who ended up testifying himself. And I also want you to tell the listeners about the Chicago Outfit mob tour that you run. Take them on a kind of an overview of that mob tour. Would you be willing to do that, Frank?
Sure.
All right,
sure.
All right, fine. Great. Aaron, I'm going to finish this off, Frank. I do a little public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to subscribe to Gangland Wire on the iTunes, because you're going to get great interviews like this one with Frank Calabrese, and you're going to want to know when the next one comes out. Then you're going to go to Amazon and you're going to buy Gangland Wire, the documentary that started it all. Go out and get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour, for $1.99. Take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations around Kansas City. And then get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination in Las Vegas.
And folks, one last thing before we close out here. Go to Chicago and take Frank's Family Secrets Tour. That's Family Secrets Tour, FamilySecretStour at gmail.com or .com. They have a website. We've got a telephone number. You can call them at 847-261-4435. If you're lucky, Frank will answer, and you'll talk to him. He will take you on a personally escorted tour around various Chicago outfit sites. Read his book, Operation Family Secrets, How a Mobster Son and the FBI Brought Down Chicago's Murderous Crime Family. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Frank.
Goodnight, guys.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.